Good evening, and thanks for listening to WAER 88.3 FM. I'm Chris Bolt, WAER News and Public Affairs Director. Tonight's panel conversation is the kickoff for City Limits, a poverty project, WAER's year-long examination of this gripping problem. I'll describe City Limits in just a moment, but first, Syracuse has been the target of some very unflattering national attention regarding poverty, news that's frankly tragic for many of our city's residents. Syracuse ranks as one of the most impoverished of the 100 largest cities in the nation. People of color, African Americans, and Hispanics are more likely to live in concentrated poverty here than in any other major city. Tonight we have a panel of people who work directly on the issue of poverty, the people it affects, the challenges it presents, from housing to nutrition, health care to addiction and mental health treatment. And you can join the conversation on social media over the next 90 minutes. Post a question or comment to the City Limits Facebook page, or you can contact us on Twitter using the hashtag City Limits Project. City Limits is a year-long, multi-platform civic engagement project produced by WAER Public Media that examines and explores poverty in Syracuse. It's a mix of journalism, storytelling, and community convening designed to spark a community-wide dialogue between individuals, organizations, and community constituencies. Each episode of the podcast project will challenge assumptions about poverty and highlight one of the many poverty-related issues ranging from food insecurity to economic development to affordable housing and more. Tonight, my guests are going to share some of the experience they've had struggling to work on the issue and research its causes and impacts. I thought I'd start by going around our table and having each of you introduce yourselves with a little bit about what you do and maybe a current observation about the state of poverty in Syracuse. Sharon?
Hi, Sharon Owens. I'm the CEO of Syracuse Community Connections. We are the managing entity of the Southwest Community Center, which is on the southwest side of town, obviously one of the high poverty areas in our city. As we look at this issue, we're realizing as a community that it is multidimensional. The components that are affected by it, the components that contribute to it, the individuals existing day by day in a state of poverty, we're challenging who they are. There's no longer, I believe, the assumption that they are individuals who just stay home and not want to engage in the economy of this community, but there are dynamics and things coming, affecting their ability to be productive in economically in this community.
Thank you, Sharon. Tim?
My name is Tim Penix. I'm the Vice President of the SUNY Syracuse Educational Opportunity Center, primarily providing academic and workforce development for disadvantaged populations within the city of Syracuse. We are a center among 10 throughout New York State, so we are part of a bigger body, but our whole focus is to really provide opportunities for those populations which we serve, which in this case is directly the individuals that we're talking about that are living within poverty within Syracuse. And as we talk about poverty and we talk about opportunity, I think one of the key things, and I'll be brief, is the success rate of us attacking poverty and having an equitable economy. That's an economy where it's equal among all areas within the city, county. I think it's critical, not just to the success of those individuals, but to the success of our region, in being a competitive region among others throughout the country.
All right, great. Thanks, Tim, for joining us. And Osha, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My name is Osha Keaton. I am the director of Greater Syracuse Hope. And what that is an initiative of the Empire State Poverty Reduction Initiative. The acronym is ESPRI. And just to piggyback off of some of the things that Sharon and Tim said, I think the thing that people really need to understand about poverty is that it has a rippling effect in our community. So it will never just be, oh, those people over there on that side of town are poor and can't get it together. If you think about it in the terms of like a community, then if you have one part of the community that is suffering and don't have like adequate access to resources, that affects the other side of towns, which affects the county, which again affects the region. So that's why the state looked at it as something that they needed to pour resources in. Mm-hmm. So we can take a look at how systems come into play to further perpetuate poverty and to keep adequate resources out of certain areas.
All right. Well, again, thanks for joining us. And Evan.
Good evening. My name is Evan Weissman. I'm assistant professor of food studies in the Department of Public Health, Food Studies and Nutrition in Falk College, Syracuse University. And I do community-based research looking at economic disparities as they relate to food systems and really sort of more importantly think about the ways in which communities are responding to disparities in access to food and to the sort of intersection of poverty and food systems. And one of the things I'm struck by is that sort of if there's anything good to come out of all this recent horrific news that we keep getting bombarded with that are really opening our eyes broadly as a region to the poverty that seems intractable in central New York is that we really are starting to see some fantastic responses to that poverty. And I certainly am heartened by some of the newfound efforts that are thinking about the ways in which programs can be better linked and better focused, and the ways in which, as OSHA just mentioned, we can be focused on systems and systems change.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you all so much for joining us and your insight already. And we'll get into a number of different questions, you know, over the next, as I said, about 79 minutes left. We'll talk about food insecurity, what it looks like and the effect, how education impacts poverty, its availability and link to a better future, and some thoughts about strategies or models that are out there that could hold promise for Syracuse and its residents struggling in the grip of poverty. But let's just start with the state of the city at present. So there's been a number of statistics, as you've referred to, that have come out. People have seen them, read them. You know, one of the things that happens is a news story comes out and people talk about it for a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they're on to the next thing. But now we've seen enough of this that it has developed more conversation around this area. Recently, we made the list as 13th poorest city in the nation. Okay, that's about average income. 2015 census statistics show if you're African American, you have a 42% chance that you live in poverty in Syracuse. Hispanic, more than 49%. Both are twice what white poverty is, which is still 25% overall in the city, double the national average. When you heard those things, when those things came out, oh, and Sharon, you had mentioned 50% of children in the city are living in poverty or in families that are in poverty. When you heard these things come out, whether it's a while back or more recently, how did they hit you? What were the reactions? I heard people say things like gut punch or like, you know, caught us blindsided, et cetera. You guys work in these fields maybe a little more closely than the average person. How did you react when you heard these things?
I'll go back to when we first heard the Paul Jaworski report. 2014.
Yeah,
I believe it was. And the reaction, depending on who was hearing it for the first time.
Right.
So for those of us who are dealing and working in communities that are impoverished, it was almost, we knew that. But even for us to hear, for me, the shock was where we ranked nationally.
Right.
Second to, amongst African Americans, to the city of Detroit. Second amongst Latinos to the city of Philadelphia, that was gut-punching for me. But the fact that we were living in entrenched poverty, and remember, that report was a housing segregation report. Mm-hmm. So when people use it and people talk about it, it's, oh, concentration of poverty and the Jaworski report. It was a housing report. So the thing about housing that we have to remember is the history of redlining that took place in so many of these communities and how housing, as OSHA has talked about and Evan and all of us are talking about, policies and systems, they just didn't happen by chance. There were mm-hmm. mechanisms placed in order that created systems, created policies that place people who were low income and in certain socioeconomic classifications in certain areas. You only lived in those certain areas. Mm-hmm. And so when we looked at that, what I think happened to the greater community, Syracuse community and Onondaga County, was, whoa. If it's right. One thing about Syracuse, it is a prideful place. And we don't like being on, we like being on the number one, you know, Final Four list.
Right, the good, list.
We don't like being on the list about we're number one in poverty and the dead last in economic development and our STD rates are dead last. You know, we don't like hearing those kind of things. So that was I say all the time, we were shamed into action. Mm-hmm. And the action was at least us start talking about it openly. And I will just say, before it gets away from, poverty is multi-generational. We have 3-4 generations of families that have lived in poverty, still living in poverty. The frustrating thing for me is that people think that in, you know, generationally, 50, 60 some odd years, then in 2-3 years, we're going to fix it. If we look to cover it up, it's going to be uncovered. Mm-hmm. If we look to delve down and dig up systems and policies that allow us not to have those systems create larger numbers of individuals in poverty or new systems of poverty, then we'll be able to address it.
Mm-hmm. The others of you, how did you hear those statistics? And as you say, maybe, you know, taking a blow to Syracuse's pride.
For me, it quantified what I already felt. I think one of the things, the interesting things about poverty is it's something that you can feel sometimes too. When you're working with people and you're doing the work, sometimes they come in with like just a heavy spirit. You could feel it. You could feel that they just feel like they don't have any other options. And if they do have options, those options are so difficult for them to navigate and maneuver that they just feel it's hopeless, for lack of a better term. So when I read the report, one thing that did shock me about the report, honestly, is the concentrated poverty. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started doing research to figure out, well, what is concentrated poverty? What does that mean?
Yeah, what does that really mean?
Yeah, and so I started going to different community events where you see all these maps. I remember the one that I went to at Upstate where they show like the map of concentrated poverty, and then they showed another map, they overlaid it and show how many gunshots were fired. And one of the things that I said during my interview with Hope is that when I looked at all those little dots and then they show like the neighborhoods where they were.
Where the reports of gunshots came from, right?
And it correlated with the concentrated poverty. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm one of those dots. And they talked about it in such a inhumane way. Mm-hmm. Like, well, this is the area and this is the census tract and the people in this census tract has this much percentages of ever making it out or they don't graduate. And I'm sitting there listening to this, someone who was from these census tracts, went to these schools, did attend college, then went on to get my master's degree, and now have been invited to sit here and receive this report as someone in the community. But the way they're giving the information to the audience is though we're a throwaway. Hmm. And that's one of the things that people don't realize about individuals who are living in this condition. It's the condition that they live in. It's not who they are. It's not what they want to live in. Mm-hmm. And so those were the two takeaways that I had from the report. Mm-hmm. The shocking fact that we were the highest in concentration, and then the reaction of those who maybe didn't know someone from those neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Tim and Evan, maybe you can address a little bit more of when you hear those statistics and they land themselves on in our city, what are the implications? What does it do to the city? Or the individuals who find themselves there, you know, whether it's regarding education and trying to get ahead or whether it's regarding how healthy you can be, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to sort of echo Sharon and think that sort of recognize that for many people, these were not shocking numbers. You know, they might have been shameful and they might have caused some alarm, but a lot of folks who have been working on the front lines in anti-poverty efforts were in some ways grateful that the conversation now is started in broader and broader circles. You know, I think that a lot has been made about this concentrated poverty, and it's really important, as OSHA just highlights, sort of what this means for the people living in these places, right? And she does a really eloquent job thinking about the ways in which these are conditions people live in. These are not the people themselves. Mm-hmm. But as Sharon noted, this was a housing report, and right. I think that we need to recognize that concentrated poverty is really problematic, and somebody used the term shameful, right? We really should be ashamed as a community that this is, you know, the ways in which our fellow citizens and community members, especially our children, are living. But we also need to recognize that addressing concentrated poverty won't necessarily get at the root causes of poverty per se. Concentration of poverty certainly exacerbates it. Mm-hmm. But what we've seen in other cities is efforts to break up that concentration have not fundamentally altered the mechanisms that are producing poverty. Mm-hmm. They're shifting it around. Mm-hmm. And so it's important that we're really mindful. And I think, again, our community is doing a really fantastic job with the leadership of HOPE and the community leaders who are coming together to think about how we challenge these sorts of intractable problems, you know, that we really sort of get a good handle at what is underlying the poverty itself. Mm-hmm. And then we can also think about some of the outcomes and then the ways in which various mechanisms exacerbate those outcomes.
And Tim, one of the – oh, go ahead.
Well, I really like what was being said And I want to add another piece to it because it was a housing report. And one of the components is that we have a very segregated community.
Right.
And that segregated community, while poverty isn't just implied over the segregation, but it is a factor when you talk about concentrated levels of Black and Latino in the city of Syracuse. And then one other point, we were one among three other cities in the top 10. So
you mean in New York?
In New York,
yeah, right.
Along the
New
Rust
York,
Belt.
Right. Yeah.
So when we look at that, we have to look at it, you know, not in the vacuum of just Syracuse, but also of what else has happened. And then as we rebuild, because we're really talking about trying to find the solutions, how are the rebuilding efforts of this community along with the other communities going to ensure that we change what was not done correctly? Mm-hmm. In the past, whether it be redlining, but clearly sharing that economic involvement, that I call it the equity, equitable economy, getting individuals involved, you know.
Yet, I mean, I live downtown. If you walk around downtown, you see evidence. Hey, there's a lot of positive indicators to point at. You mentioned earlier before we were on air about the unemployment rate being below 5%. Some economists call that full employment. Okay. If you go to the downtown committee's progress breakfast, you know, billions of dollars of investment. Yet there's a tremendous disconnect from positive things. Syracuse is on a list of one of the best cities for millennials to live in because of technology businesses and nice coffee shops and, you know, an artistic community that's growing. There's arrows that point up, right. But they don't seem to affect this.
Absolutely.
Why is that? Tell me, Tim. Solve it for us. No, I mean, it is this weird juxtaposition that you see positive things and you'd think, I don't know if it's an all raises all boats kind of thing, but you think things are trending up. It should impact poverty. And in fact, it's almost as though it doesn't.
Because Syracuse, I made an offhand comment once. Syracuse is like the tale of two cities, the modern day tale of two cities. And that hit home for me one time when I was downtown, I was leaving one of the many mayoral debates. Mm-hmm. It was all these like thought leaders, right. You know, listening. And as I walked out, it was a man sleeping on the bench just right outside where we were having like all this conversation about economic development and who had the brightest idea. And here is somebody right now that the conversation we're having does not directly impact him. He needs help now. And we're talking about community grids, which, yes, that should be talked about. But he's right here in front of us. And it's mm-hmm. like we don't see him because we're so focused on
right.
something else.
30,000-foot level or whatever. Yeah,
I think one of the economic mistakes we make, and Tim started this conversation, it was very valid, is that we correlate a low unemployment rate with poverty.
Right.
And we shouldn't make that mistake. Mm-hmm. Because statistically, you have to be the unemployment rate is determined by individuals who have been in the workforce and then out of the workforce for a year, mm-hmm. 12
Most
months.
Year, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for 12 months. When you're talking about people
and are looking for work
and are looking right, for work, right. And when you're talking about people who are in entrenched poverty, cyclical, mm-hmm. they just can't get out of it. These are not folks that are even anywhere on that radar.
They're not represented by that
at
number
all.
In any way.
At all.
I would just add, speaking about sort of the economic development that we're witnessing in the city of Syracuse, which we should rightly be proud of, mm-hmm. Tim made a really important point, and that is that we're talking about poverty outcomes that were deliberate.
Right.
They are produced not just by systems, as OSHA keeps talking about, but those systems include policies.
Right.
And we need to ensure that if the economic development that we're witnessing in Syracuse and hope to attract more of, we need to be deliberate to ensure that it's inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
We can't just assume that it's going to trickle down. And we also can't assume that the existing practices, however well-intentioned, are themselves going to start to break up poverty, and especially poverty in its concentrated form. So we have to be mindful that where we find ourselves is not just sort of the outcome of, history.
Mm-hmm.
There's real deliberate sorts of development policies, housing policies, criminal justice policies, education policies that have all sort of collectively worked to mm-hmm. create this sort of problem.
Let me zero in also on one other issue another issue, and we have more issues to come in the remaining portion of the City Limits panel discussion here going up until 8 o'clock. Food insecurity, it's like the most basic need you have to eat. Even really before housing, although housing is obviously a super basic need.
Especially in the winter.
Yeah. But, Evan, this is really your area. Can you shed some light? Or I thought we could shed some light on what struggles are out there, and that, people who aren't in poverty connect with this because they donate at Thanksgiving and Christmas to food banks,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe more. I don't want to downplay people. There's certainly wonderful, generous people and programs out there. But, what does it look like in terms of people trying to feed themselves and, maybe, as you said, how policies kind of impact that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, in the United States, hunger and food insecurity look a lot different than in other parts of the world, to
mm-hmm.
be sure. And that's thanks to a charitable-based emergency food system that makes sure people don't, for the most part, starve to death in our country. But we, also need to recognize, of course, that food insecurity, which is generally thought of as not understanding or not being secure in where your next meal is coming from,
mm-hmm.
It is in some ways actually a modern phenomenon in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Through federal policies emerging, out of the Great Depression and then sort of magnified because of the great work of the Black Panther Party, for example, in the early 1970s, the United States pretty much through federal policy had a handle on hunger and food insecurity, and it was all but solved.
Hmm.
And when we're being real specific about what causes poverty, we have the creation of a Reagan economics that emerges in the early 1980s and then, gets perpetuated by, Clinton-style Democratic policies and so-called welfare reform that continues to exacerbate poverty. And so we have greater economic inequality in this country than we did in the 1970s. And that one of the places we see that most clearly are in the outcomes produced from food system inequalities, especially disparities in access, which create all sorts of nutritional deficits, which create all sorts of very negative public health consequences that then are linked, say, to the ability for people to achieve optimal education. And so here's another place that we see really great work being done to address the problem where it lies, whether you're talking about the fact that every child in the city school district now gets breakfast and lunch. And some schools, they're doing dinner and sending kids mm-hmm. home with food.
Right.
But at the end of the day, that's not fundamentally addressing what causes the inability for people to obtain the sorts of foods that they need for a healthful life. And again, we're talking about the fact that food is a commodity, meaning you secure it in a market like you do anything else, mm-hmm. a pen, piece of paper, technology, a cell phone, and something that's so basic to life is governed by market forces. And then you also talk about policies that have continued to restrict the government's responsibility for taking care of the most vulnerable populations. And so the outcomes are much different than what hunger looks like elsewhere or looked like in the United States 50 years ago, where now you have a whole host of chronic diet-related diseases that emerge in people who are poor and cannot sort of adequately feed themselves and their families.
Yeah, I was also thinking that as you started to mention food availability and just consistency of not only quantity but quality of food has effects, health effects, you know, how kids perform at school, probably even energy in adults into going to try to do the next thing, whatever that step is to get basic needs met or to get the next thing going. So food is more than just you could go get food for a meal.
I mean, the bottom line is that the basic need of the human body is to fill itself up with food. Mm-hmm. And if you're eating foods that meet that need, whether they be high sugar or highly processed foods, you know, having the money to go and buy those god-awful high salt noodle package things.
All right.
And you eat those. And
sodium on top of sodium.
I mean,
just
and
out
you
water.
Eat it, right. you satisfy your innate need to be full. You know, high sugar drinks because they're a quarter as opposed to getting some juice, orange juice, and going to the store and getting that, and it's $1.25.
Right.
So what are you going to do when you have a dollar in your pocket? Well, you're going to get three of those little juicy jug things that drive me nuts.
Gotcha. Well, we are going to take our first break for the evening. You're listening to City Limits, a Poverty Project. This conversation is our kickoff event for our year-long investigation of poverty. You can join tonight's conversation on the City Limits Facebook page or on Twitter with a question or comment using the hashtag City Limits Project. Coming up, for many, a path out of poverty has to include a more solid future, which usually means some employment, the training to get there. How does our local economy prevent someone from rising up, and what educational opportunities are around to help? Thanks for listening to City Limits on WAER Syracuse. I'm Chris Bolt.
Support for
WAER. You're listening to City Limits on WAER Syracuse. The city of Syracuse gained national attention, quite unflattering attention, with our poverty ranking and statistics that show concentrated poverty for blacks and Hispanics among the worst in the nation of any major city. People on the front lines of trying to help the city and its struggling residents join me for more discussion over the next hour. I want to welcome in Osha Keaton from the Syracuse Hope Project, Evan Weissman from SU Food Studies, a professor, Sharon Owens from the Syracuse Model Neighborhood Facility, the CEO, and Tim Penix from the SUNY Syracuse Educational Opportunity Center. And you can join our discussion on City Limits. You can go to the Facebook page City Limits WAER or join us on Twitter using the hashtag City Limits Project with a question or comment. And as we talked about some issues over the past half hour, I wanted to get into education and training and the ability someone might have to take that step toward a better future. And Tim, let's start with what that first step might look like for someone who's trying to get some kind of income or someone in poverty who's ready to move in that direction. You know, what kind of opportunities are out there? Are they utilized enough? And kind of what are the barriers for somebody who might want to do it to actually do it?
Well, the barriers are many, but it depends on the individual. So I'll focus on just the opportunities that I know are there. And I will hope everybody can share in some of the barriers, because they're going to be wide ranging, child care to, you know, past work history to a number of different things.
Right.
But as far as the opportunities go, you know, there are a number of organizations that have been here, but also more that are developing, that are providing workforce development training programs. Some targeted towards health fields, some targeted towards the improving manufacturing that's happening in Syracuse. I know people like to think that manufacturing went away in Syracuse. It may have lessened its profile, but there still are manufacturing jobs.
It morphed into the specialty, smaller, yeah.
Pretty much, right. Yeah, pretty much. Right. As well as, you know, your typical, you know, your Central New York Works, Syracuse EOC, Health Train Central. There's a collective group that have really looked at aligning workforce opportunities with individuals who are hard to employ. Mm-hmm. Now, an example could be, you know, there are some organizations that require a high school diploma. Well, some individuals don't have a high school diploma, but they were excellent workers. So, and this is through WorkTrain, they've been able to develop a relationship with the employer to talk to the employer to determine what are your specific needs that may not necessarily pertain to a high school diploma. Then we as the EOC have helped work with that individual to then gain that employment.
Mm-hmm.
With the expectation that they will get their high school diploma or high school equivalency.
Right.
I want to make sure I don't, you know, negate the fact that they still need to get that, because
right.
just getting an employment isn't really the key to getting out of employment, poverty. Getting into a career track or a sustainable income is really the key. And sometimes the entry level positions don't necessarily get you to that point. That's why we're also looking at the underemployed.
Mm-hmm.
People who are working, who wouldn't come up on an unemployment list, which is why the rates may be at a certain level, but are still in poverty.
Right.
And they're working some cases two or three jobs just trying to make ends meet, but need to find something that's a little bit more sustainable, especially as they age on in years.
I could imagine that individual, it's really hard, because they don't even if they have the desire, they probably have the motivation because they're working multiple jobs.
Right.
Probably out of a sense of duty to family. It's probably largely that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yet where do they have the time to come to a program or get education or go to a EOC or OCC or a Bryant and Stratton, you know, not even a degree program but right. a certificate program?
And that's where it's on us as the trainers. We have to develop flexible programs. We have to start to develop what we do that meets the needs of the client and the employer, not necessarily the needs of education where, you know, we start in September and we end in May and everybody goes away for the summer. In farms, that's how we were designed, but no one farms anymore. So the reality is we have to address that need, and we are. We're continually looking at not necessarily a program that fits an academic calendar, but a program that fits the need of the employer. But still reaching out and getting the right individuals for the right opportunity is always a challenge. Because that's when you have to really work with the individual mm-hmm. on an individualized basis to find out how they overcome those barriers.
Well, and it seems as from a policy standpoint, that's so difficult because you can't – there's no one size fits all. There's not even a 10 sizes fit all. Like, it's so individual that – I mean, let's face it. That's a policy challenge that the city has to find a way to do something about.
Yeah.
There are 16 ESPRI communities, of mm-hmm. which 15 or 16, that Greater Syracuse Hope was birthed out of from mm-hmm. the governor's initiative. And whether or not there's a discrepancy or whether or not this is accurate to a 100% point, but it's accurate enough for people living in poverty and working mm-hmm. and living in poverty, is that across the board, all of us see the same policy dynamic, and mm-hmm. it's called the cliff effect. Mm-hmm. So there is a discrepancy about whether and how really effective and how much it really applies to individuals. But the bottom line is that we're encouraging people to get to work. They're going to great trainings like Tim offers, getting their certificates or their entry-level degrees, and they're getting work, and it's placing them just over the eligibility for whether it's food stamps or housing subsidy or a child care subsidy, all of which are critical.
Mm-hmm.
We go to work every day. The way I'm able to be able to function the next day is that I can go home and sleep in a safe, affordable, clean home.
Mm-hmm.
I can get a decent meal. when my children were smaller. I had child care available. But when you don't have that, when those are taken, so a policy issue that we're talking about is how do we transition people mm-hmm. instead of them hitting the cliff and then losing all of the mm-hmm. supports, you know, that keep them stable while you're transitioning into work, particularly if it's you haven't been traditionally working. We talked about some of the barriers. One, just a couple. Child care is an obvious one.
Mm-hmm.
If there's one area that I think the state really works hard to try to meet that gap is the child care area,
mm-hmm.
in that area. No one can go to work and work a sound day and be effective if they're not sure that their children are well cared for. No one can do that. But we one of the great things I hear about from people who come to Syracuse is that you could be anywhere in 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's if you have a car.
Right.
Okay. So recently in the news, the woman who works out at Jamesville Correctional Facility is taking two buses, one to the bus hub and then one out to a mile away from the Jamesville Correctional Facility and walking the rest of the way.
On a highway.
Pregnant.
On a highway.
Pregnant.
In the summer.
Pregnant?
The
is that what you said?
9 months pregnant.
Yeah. Pregnant.
Goodness gracious.
And,
yeah.
and bless her soul, she gets up and she does that same thing every single day. United Way recently has classified individuals like that woman as Alice.
Right.
Asset limited, income constrained, employed. These are people that not only work one job, but probably two jobs, who get up every day, who go to work, who are still what I call hopscotching around the poverty mm-hmm. line. And those individuals are those individuals that Tim talks about that aren't that entry level. They have work experience.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get them to that next level of sustainability?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And to Sharon's point, I brought some numbers about temporary assistance families and mm-hmm. what's the max they can earn before they're cut off from right. food stamps or mm-hmm. public assistance. And a family of three earned income limit is $16,561. That translates out to $1,380.10 per month before they lose their benefits. A family of three. That's unbelievable. How can you sustain yourself? So the only
sure.
other thing you can do is get a job. But then when you get that increase in wage.
So if you make more than that 16,000 figure
mm-hmm.
family of three, so that could be a couple with a child or an
right.
individual parent with two children, which is probably a very common family
sure.
unit.
Right, right.
So $16,000 and then they would lose. Now, is that a... When you say cliff, Sharon, I've heard that phrase referred to because of the Alice designation that's, you know, come into my lexicon in the last mm-hmm. year. Is that a cliff meaning at that level you lose housing assistance and food and child care? Or do you lose one, then the next, then the next?
It can be more of a slope sometimes.
But it's a steep slope.
But if you're, you know, we've been pushing $10 an hour and trying to get people to $15 an hour and livable wages.
Right.
When you're in that, when you begin to earn that level, mm-hmm. which when you look at it across the board for a family of four or five or six, that you're not, you know, you're not rolling in money.
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah, right.
But
I mean, $10 an hour if you work full time is $20,000.
Exactly.
A year, so.
Right.
Exactly. And, you know, let's just make sure everybody understands this. No one wants to spend half of their day in the second floor of the Civic Center.
Right.
Doing all the paperwork and meeting with all the staff there to receive services. No one wants to do that. That is not a good mm-hmm. existence for people. So hopefully what we're looking at is understanding that first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Did you have other things you were going to share? I mean, that poverty statistic is a really excellent one in terms of the income at which you lose benefit because,
yeah.
as you said, you're not rolling in any money and
right.
now you've lost. And so were there other points you were going to make about that?
No. I think that point is strong enough in itself
mm-hmm.
because especially because I have had conversations with policymakers and
mm-hmm.
sometimes, you know, when you work in a system, sometimes you could be so wedded to the way the system operates that you don't readily see it until you make it personal. So one of the things that a question that I posed was, if someone gave you 30 days to adjust to a 30% reduction in your take-home pay, would you be all right?
Mm-hmm.
And I met silence at the table. So this is what – so we're expecting people who are barely making it as it is to – bounce back from a 30% reduction in their take home of you know, food stamps. And that's a basic right, the ability to eat. That's what Evan was talking about earlier. That's a basic right. So now you're scrambling. And so now you have to pick up another job. So maybe you can't go to Tim's program anymore because now you're working two jobs to make up for that loss of the 30% income, when in reality, this is what we mean by systems exacerbating the condition of poverty. If one system just communicates with the other system, then maybe his system, Evans, can become better. And you won't have food insecurity. This is an example.
Tim, you or Evan, you were talking about this earlier, and you know, a phrase I used more from the health world is comorbidity. You know, doctors are treating more than one condition, but you realize there's other conditions that exacerbate that. Sandy Lane from the Falk School of Nutrition talks about syndemics, which is basically the same thing about multiple issues affecting. Now, here we're talking about affecting what you can make or how you can make it, but so many factors impact, and you can't just solve one thing. Or you solve one thing, you create other problems.
Yeah, and I want to go sort of piggyback on what OSHA's saying and go back to something that Tim and Sharon were so clearly highlighting. And it's not just a matter of people don't want to spend their day in the second floor of the Civic Center, but people also have dignity. And at the end of the day, a lot of the folks who do this sort of work have a very different take on human nature than what we are led to believe. For people who don't encounter folks who are not like them, you know, through a variety of, you know, sort of images that are depicted from sort of the welfare queen or the undeserving poor, you know, so we need to sort of start by seeing people as individuals and recognize that those who work with people in poverty on the front lines recognize that these are folks who are struggling to take care of themselves and their families and get themselves out of these conditions. And when we're talking about things sort of like this cliff, we're thinking here about federal policies that prohibit folks from being able to move themselves out of poverty, which should be our goal, whether it's our goal because we're thinking about other citizens and the life opportunities and chances and health people have, or whether it's our goal as taxpayers, recognizing that we want folks to have the ability to contribute to our overall economy. But we can also then think about local policies, right? So we've talked a bit about transportation policies, for example. You know, but I also can think about sort of the ways in which our economic development leaders could inscribe into, you know, the projects that they support, job benefits agreements that ensure folks going through TIMS programs have jobs. Or I'm thinking about the good work that State University of New York, SUNY and CUNY did to ban the box that asked about criminal histories on employment applications and recognize in a city like Syracuse, when you have a lot of folks, especially black men who have been incarcerated, have another barrier to either educational attainment or to job attainment. These are some real localized policies that we could be working on to try to transcend the problem.
To Evan's point, I recently had the opportunity to meet with a group of Center State CEO members, and we began to talk about poverty. It is multi-generational and it's multi-dimensional. It has to have multi-dimensional approaches. And what I said to that group and what I say to my peers in the not-for-profit world is that sometimes we have to get over our own stuff. So we kind of mend the symptoms of poverty. We're helping people to eat. We're making sure they're clothed. We're getting they're educated and making sure they're housed. But And poverty is psychological and social and emotional. But by definition, it is financial. And so the business community, and that was what we talked about in that meeting, the role. Poverty is bad for your business. Sure, you are not going to attract the most talented people to this community. Your business is not going to grow to its greatest potential when all of these stats are telling you that everyone here is dirt poor and the city's not moving anywhere. So they were extremely receptive to understanding the role of business and how you conduct business, not just in even in your internal HR practices and how you're looking at the qualities of individuals and the qualifications of individuals when you're applying, hiring.
And that HR department sometimes is a real barrier because they have on a job application. Absolutely. That person needs XYZ degree level or certificate training when the job doesn't really require
and
that.
And many of them have not banned the box.
And Tim, you had talked about this earlier, and I was wondering, do people it's a little bit of a higher order thinking, or you have to put a couple things together to realize that a business locally that solves an employment situation for one or two people is really benefiting the region.
Absolutely.
I mean, you had mentioned that before, that, you know, a success of individuals is success of the region. Absolutely. Do people, you think, get that? Is that kind of a hard thing to get through to businesses who might not really think about that? You're thinking about your bottom line and did your inventory come in and you have a position to fill and you want the best employee, not what could these things do, you know, for the area, for the region.
I think when we talk about it individually, people understand it because it's really not a heavy lift logically.
No, it's logical,
but
right.
When it comes to practice, I think like many things that you intend seem to kind of get skewed. And that I don't think, you know, again, I can't speak for all the employers,
sure.
But something that I was talking about earlier during the break, and I'm going to bring – I want to make one point, too, about poverty. And I'll go back to that because I keep forgetting. We're talking about poverty. We're talking about Syracuse. And we're talking about contrary levels within Syracuse. But we cannot neglect that rural poverty is just as impactful and is just as probably as many or as much, but it's just spread out. And some of the same things we're talking about that are happening inside the city of Syracuse are happening in some of the small hamlets and areas in Madison County, Onondaga County, Fulton, and other places. We're coming to a fork in the roads as a country when we have this disparity in wealth. And the middle class is clearly what we should be talking about building from all places. I just want to make sure I bring that point in because when we start talking about the region and how the economic development, economic leaders are looking at it. One thing with this region, and again, it's still early. Mm-hmm. We haven't even got our first report card yet. But we've taken steps to kind of look at that and how to have an equitable economy. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that you'll hear about from the AEI that was put forth.
The AEI is the Alliance for Economic Inclusion.
Right. It was part of the URI, which is part of the Upstate Revitalization Initiative, which is now called CNY Rising.
Right. There's so many acronyms, alphabet soup, but I'm glad we got that in there. Because people will see AEI, and I know you're part of that, and I wanted to get out there. But
the point is to be intentional. Have intentionality of what we're trying to do. And starting with how do you address it, and in some cases looking at it from our urban area because that's where the center of our region is, but ensuring that if it's not expandable, it's exportable to other areas because that's also part of our region. Mm-hmm. You know, we are the Central New York region. We want to be as competitive with every other region and every other city in the country. I would believe in the way that I would want my children to live, as well as many of you, that you want to have a prosperous community. You can't have these large pockets and places where people are in abject poverty. You can't. But another point, I'm moving away from the next one to make sure I talked about the rural versus the urban. It's the same. It's just how do you address it? There may be different nuances to it. You know, one thing within Syracuse and in particular that has I think we've missed, we've had a talent drain.
Right.
From all levels. You know, as the economy kind of went in, you know, south a little bit, we had a number of people leaving, and these were the people that we wanted to keep. And these are our college graduates that have been successful. And in particular, in the minority community, it was even more impactful. You know, I'm originally from Rome, New York, and we used to think of Syracuse as the big prosperous city. You know, and especially when it came to the minority communities, you look to that to say, wow, that's a really prosperous minority community. But what occurred over those years were many of the individuals coming from the same schools that we now are calling, you know, in need, have gone on because they couldn't get engaged in our economy. And if anyone's listening who may not be part of some of these conversations already, that's a critical component. Say Yes, On Point, and many of these programs are doing everything known to get kids into school and then to be successful in school. We're very fortunate as a community across the state. There are states, cities that are trying to get to this point
now. No, I mean, there are some things that really we have that other communities would love to have.
Now, the key is to turn that into working for our favor. And yes, mm-hmm. being very greedy, we want you to stay. We want you to graduate mm-hmm. and work in Syracuse and decide that you might want to stay forever, work for a couple right. years and leave. But the reality is that that's something that I think we haven't really capitalized on yet, because I still think there's this, I don't know how you want to call it, it's a perception on maybe race or ethnicity, or on that it might be better from some other places. I'm not sure mm-hmm. and don't really care. But I think it's just an important factor that we have to keep in mind, because that's going to be the thing to turn around a lot of the concerns that we have in these communities, from leadership, economic drivers, starting businesses. You know, there's a new business that started. I'll give them a shameless plug. Blue Chick. It started from young men who decided that they wanted to have a restaurant / establishment that catered to progressive young millennials of color. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we've been working on as far as a community. We need those in our community because it's more attractive than, say, the Charlottes or the Philadelphias, the other places where all these young people want to leave too.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. I mean, we've touched on a lot of things related to the economy, about things such as when you lose your public assistance after mm-hmm. you make just a little more money, kind of all the things I had specific questions about. So you guys are doing a really very excellent job of that. You're listening to City Limits on WAER. You can join the conversation on social media with a comment or question on Twitter. Use the hashtag City Limits Project. Or find our City Limits Facebook page. It's City Limits WAER. Coming up, we've talked about the problems of nutrition and just getting food on the table, plus connections between some kind of education and a job that might start a path out of poverty. Next, what about the barriers of housing and substance abuse, mental health? How is the community reacting to problems that can be barriers for any improvement in someone's life and that of their family? This is WAER Syracuse. Tim Penix, Vice President of SUNY Syracuse Educational Opportunity Center, Evan Weissman, Syracuse University Food Studies Professor, and Sharon Owens, CEO of Syracuse Model Neighborhood Facility. In a moment, we're going to talk about one of the most obvious signs of poverty, not having a good home. But first, we want to go back to a question that someone gave to us on social media, somebody who was interested in young people working, and they make the comment, Carrie makes the comment, that they see many young people from other countries employed here. Why can't our own students be prepared for life with work? And then makes a comment about if it's possible for Syracuse City youth to have more opportunities for summer work. And I know the city does something about this. I don't know how to the extent of available jobs versus available need.
The city school district has in recent years kind of shifted their focus on initiatives like Fowler. What's Fowler now?
Public.
The new program they have
right,
there now.
That's very work-focused and employment-focused.
Absolutely. Right. And ITC has always been, has worked along those lines. I think that when we talked about, and I don't know if we were on the air or off the air, but we were talking about the shift in manufacturing has shifted. The other shift that's happened is high tech, mm-hmm. more so for individuals, and really being preparing our kids for that industry.
Mm-hmm. Which is a lot of the growth, and it's a lot of the millennial. We were talking about millennial, attractive to millennials. Those are the businesses.
Absolutely. Right. When, you know, we were talking offline, I think it was, and I was saying back in the, you know, early 90s when I became new to Syracuse, and all of my friends, families worked at New Process Gear and Miller and all of those factories, mm-hmm. that you didn't need a college degree to work in and earn a great living and send your kids to college and so forth. That has shifted a bit, mm-hmm. and now we're looking at high tech. But understanding that our kids have the innate skills to be able to do to work. The other thing about our work industry we have to really begin to understand is that you don't have to be in an office and sit in a desk anymore. The World Wide Web and cyber technology and the ability to be employed by someone in California or downtown Syracuse, right from your desktop and your computer, and the ability to be functioning at that level. I think we need to spend a little bit more attention to that.
Mm-hmm. And I want to add to piggyback on Sharon, but also adding to what I said before, when I talked about talent and individuals going to college, I just want to make sure I clarify, you don't have to go to college to be considered talent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure that that's clear because there are a lot of opportunities that may not necessarily require a college degree that are also viable opportunities as well as much needed resources. We're looking at cliffs when we start talking about the retirement, the baby boomers getting out of the workforce in jobs like plumbing, national grid linemen across the board that are viable employment opportunities for someone.
And now, those are places where a business that needs that work, and these are
absolutely
pretty good-paying jobs,
absolutely
recognizes that they need to reach down. Is there a similar need for employers to say, hey, we should put these high school teenagers, et cetera, to work to start to develop what I think this person on Facebook was trying to get at is younger people, youth, getting some sense of work, getting some a little bit of a foot up in a work situation? Is some of that responsibility not on the city of Syracuse but on every Syracuse employer to develop something for young people?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I believe that OnPoint has just started like an internship type of opportunity that is seeking to address some of those issues. But it goes back also to what Sharon was saying earlier. This is where the businesses need to step up or step in and maybe like foster some type of apprenticeships programs, because you can have an apprentice for plumbing, electrician at an early age and see what sparks that child's interest. And I think that is what the Syracuse City School District is doing. It just jogged my mind. The Fowler School is now called the Public Service Leadership Academy, PSLA.
Thank you, Osha. Forgive me.
I would add, like to add to Carrie's point and to sort of, sort of bring a few things that Osha's noting together. I mean, there are some really fantastic summer youth employment programs in the city of Syracuse, a lot of which actually have to do with my area of expertise, which is food. But these programs are funded through state and private grants. And to your point, we need to see more business engaging this. Right. My strongest students here at Syracuse University go to internships in major cities around the country and wind up oftentimes securing future employment post-graduation in those same places, oftentimes in the same firms.
Absolutely.
And so we have great summer programs here, and to his credit, the mayor-elect is actually interested in expanding them.
Right,
but we do want to see business taking some leadership here. Mm-hmm. I do also then want to link to Carrie's other question related to sort of folks from other countries employed here. And I'm not exactly sure where she's getting at, but I read this as linking to, again, another policy question, and that is the real abysmal state of public education in the United States, which is under attack. It's been under attack by both Democratic and Republican leaders. Mm-hmm. And if we're thinking about sort of strategies for preparing young people to have opportunities to participate in our economy, we need strong schools from pre-K through SUNY, through public higher education. And then we also need these alternative sorts of programs. And I'm fond of our school board. I have, three children and two of whom are already in the public schools. I'm a graduate of the Syracuse City School District myself. Unfortunately, my school was one of the ones that was closed, Hughes. But I do think here's a good example where, in some ways, our leadership missed the mark, right? The Public Service Leadership Institute at Fowler is focused on training people to sort of be security, part of the security apparatus, and to engage in some sort of basic trades of service rather than thinking about economic futures around technology, around addressing climate change, around the green economy. And again, here's places where we really could think not just about sort of the national policies as barriers, but local opportunities to transcend those barriers.
We are the hub of the global economy when it comes to drone technology.
Right. No, it's a whole field.
So
exactly.
If we are not going to be purposeful, as Tim says, in including all parts of our community, mm-hmm. all parts of our economy in that industry that is going to lead this country, this region, this world. We are on the pinnacle of looking at something amazing. Mm-hmm. But how are we going to make the same mistake again? Is it just going to be for the individuals who have found their way into that industry, and many times because bridges mm-hmm. have been made for them to get there? Mm-hmm. Or are we going to build bridges for individuals who would have never thought of that industry, mm-hmm. but have the innate technology and skill sets mm-hmm. to be able to do? I will say to you, even for individuals who have come into buildings that are doing that amazing work, they may even been doing office work or mm-hmm. even mm-hmm. groundskeeper or anything. It's the exposure.
Absolutely. That's what I was going
to
say.
To something you have never experienced.
On point for Colleges Plus is it introduces college as an option to people who wouldn't have thought so. So if you take that model and mm-hmm. say you introduce somebody to a business opportunity that they mm-hmm. never would have even known they might have a passion for, mm-hmm. and it does benefit everyone. I want to pivot us a little just to get to a couple other points before we run out of time at 8 o'clock. As I mentioned before, an obvious sign of poverty is not having a solid place or a comfortable or safe place to live. Certainly homelessness might be the very most basic view or image of poverty. Certainly some kind of housing has to be an initial step out of poverty. What's the state of housing availability from shelter to transitional housing to something that's affordable in this community, knowing that there's efforts in many cases? Even in some cases, we have been groundbreaking through the Syracuse Housing Authority at different times. Mm-hmm. Yet, as we mentioned earlier, there's some real systemic problems that the city has in its history that have created some real, real challenges around housing. I mean, Sharon, I know it was probably the best to address this to begin with.
Well, there's absolute synergy between poverty and substandard housing, without question, whether it be lead-infused insects and rodents. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, unaffordable. That you have a four-bedroom apartment that is, completely inappropriate for, human habitation, but you're still spending $800-$900 a month to live there. Mm-hmm. There is clearly strong communities are communities that have a mix of socioeconomic housing. Strong communities, strong neighborhoods have a mix of individuals who are low, middle, and upper mm-hmm. income individuals who are diverse across all kind of socioeconomic and racial lines. That is where we have started this story. Mm-hmm. We come full circle to concentrated poverty and poor housing mm-hmm. stock. One thing I think we need to do, and part of what we're looking at HOPE, is we've been traditionally adversarial with absentee landlords. Many of them deservedly need to be adversarial. But somehow we have to identify landlords who are willing to be partners in the solution. Mm-hmm. And what has not been...
Well, there are some.
There are some, absolutely.
Housing Visions projects.
Even private. Right. You find them here and there. We know them. They're our neighbors. They're next to us, and they've been renting a building, and they take mm-hmm. care of it, and they're good property owners. And we have to have a two-prong approach to this. Holding those accountable who are not meeting code, who are not allowing people to live in habitable, clean, affordable, safe housing, and then also incentivizing those that are doing well, right. who are maintaining,
Well, maybe telling those stories a little more, too.
Absolutely.
You don't hear about the public housing person you're talking about. Maybe it's a landlord that takes Section 8
quietly,
and everything is in really good
shape.
You hear about the problems.
Home. They quietly right. take care of their property. Yeah. Their tenants have been there forever. We want to get them to be homeowners, but they're content in their apartment and they're living wonderfully there. But existing programs, and this is, again, where private industry has to come in, because existing housing-related programs do not provide funding to help that homeowner, that property owner fix their rent, mm-hmm. upgrade their electrical, continue to do some things that will help improve. And let's incentivize good landlords and property owners to buy more property. Sure. communities.
Mm-hmm. I would add, I mean, here's another clear example where we've got these connections. Mm-hmm. Because going, again, out of my area of expertise, thinking about food, if someone has adequate food and adequate access to food, they still need a safe kitchen to cook mm-hmm. in. They need mm-hmm. a stove that works. They need to know that the water they're boiling their pasta in is safe and not mm-hmm. full of lead. And again, I think thinking about the role that private industry plays, you know, we see a lot of great economic development downtown. We could think about ways to incentivize inclusive housing within the developments that are occurring so that it's not concentrated. And again, as someone who likes to look at our future as, you know, sort of through the lens of a glass half full, we have an amazing opportunity right. here with the future of 81. And I yeah. think our mayor-elect said it best when he said it's time that we stop discussing what's the right decision and think about how the right decision works for the city of Syracuse. Mm-hmm. Right? We can bring down this highway, we can reconnect our city, and we can create some really exciting economic development opportunity. But it has to be deliberate. We can't assume that the right outcomes are going right. to follow. We have to think about who's employed in this transition, right? We have to think about what the future looks like. And we have to be mindful that it's us. It's right. all of us that are determining what this future looks like.
Absolutely.
I wanted to turn to one other thing, which in my research as the City Limits Project has been getting going, has just come up. Admittedly, an obstacle we know is there, but more often and more prevalent than I expected, which is substance abuse. And substance abuse and mental health, I know, are related. I mean, sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other, sometimes it's both for some people. But how do you see substance abuse as just being a complicated factor as you're trying to solve any of the things we've talked about for the last, you know, hour and almost hour and a half? It does seem to raise its head as the problem that needs to be solved. But boy, before you can start working on, are you going to start some training issue? Are you going to be able to, you know, take that, whatever that step is to rise up, if you want to use that sort of cliche term. But substance abuse treatment availability seems like a natural place to start. But boy, it really has become an obstacle for a family or an individual to do better.
I mean, I can start because, you know, I'm within a Department of Public Health, and mm-hmm. so my colleagues would clearly educate us in thinking that we do still have a great deal of work to do to recognize substance abuse as a public health problem. Mm-hmm. We might agree on that in this room, and you might see some important shifts in the public conversation, but there is a yawning gap between what even our congressional leader is saying and what actions have been taken. We also see, you know, a great deal of barriers related to people being able to, in, you know, rely on some of the federal benefits. You know, we see, you know, those continually under, you know, onslaught from, you know, conservative political leaders who want to sort of put more barriers in the way of folks working to try to both get into recovery and get out of poverty. And so I think, you know, first and foremost, we need to see it as a public health problem. And we still don't fully do that. Mm-hmm. And we need to then also hold, you know, our medical industry, especially drug makers, accountable because they've done a great deal of damage. And then we need to really start to think about the strategies we deploy as a community to fundamentally address these problems, which sometimes are linked, not always, of mental health and, mm-hmm. and drug addiction.
Well, both are treatment issues where sure. there not only needs to be a philosophy behind yeah. treatment, as you're talking about, but availability of treatment. I mean, recently speaking to someone who works with people in transitional housing, they were talking about, you know, 3 weeks of drug treatment doesn't stabilize anybody. Somebody who finally has mental health treatment might take 6 months to a year to get stabilized on medications, you know, prescription drugs, mm-hmm. not illegal drugs. And that's not what happens. So that the very quick even attention to the problems doesn't get to a solution to the problems or a little more stability for the person, which I'm sure impacts their ability to then do the next thing, which would be training or job or anything.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean the bottom line, again, is philosophical and purposeful. The same opiate attention we have right now going on.
Mm-hmm.
The opiate now is prescription drugs. the same opiate for 20, 30 years in Syracuse, particularly in certain sections of town, was heroin addiction. Right. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was deemed as criminal and treated as a criminal act.
Right.
And now it is deemed as a health crisis. Thankfully, now that it is.
Right.
But again, it is the systems and purposeful laws that are created and policies that are created that target certain populations that create dynamics. Mm-hmm. And until that, I always say, be wary of the ailment that affects your neighbor, because soon it's going to come knocking at your own door. And what we're finding in areas of substance abuse and mental health is exactly that. And so that knocking on my own door now is creating a global shift in how we're looking at substance abuse and mental illness. That is great.
Mm-hmm.
Now the resources. It costs money to treat the number of people we're talking about. And
sure.
Is this community and our larger community really committed to spending that kind of money? Because, again, I will say that drug addicted or mentally ill individuals are not going to help your bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they live in poverty, middle income, or upper income, it does not matter. That is one of the one areas that physical health and public health, its effects do not discriminate. Mm-hmm. Cancer kills. It doesn't matter how rich or poor you are. How you acquire it or how you become ill is affected by where you are in our socioeconomic climate.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yes, addiction, it doesn't discriminate, but what discriminates is how they give the help.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, if you have private health insurance, then you're able to afford those beds in a clinic and you're able to get in there and get that treatment. But if you're on Medicaid, and then you have to go to certain treatment facilities that are already overbooked, and in some cases, like far out, not even within reach of the Syracuse area, then it becomes barrier on top of barriers. And again, once again, we're back to systems. We're back to policies.
Right.
You can even do a broader look and think about, and I might be, getting too radical on this one, but think about marijuana. When it was illegal and it was bad, and you're smoking dope, but now they have it's medicinal. And they have industries, but are you going to go back and rescind all those sentences of those people that you put in jail? No.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I said this is the difference between laws for crack versus cocaine.
Right.
Shows how, from a policy standpoint, from laws, it affected one population extremely harder than it did another while it was basically the same drug.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the impact on the communities, you could have discussions forever how one, but still, you talk about numbers and numbers of people that were put in jail that, right now we're really still trying to dig out from in some communities.
Because
you're talking about generational leadership.
Right.
Well, and then all those people who then have a very challenging future. So even if that person, wherever they were before they went in, when they come out, they enter this poverty group we're talking about because they have real struggles getting jobs.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
The challenges, ex-offender and transition from ex-offenders are major obstacles.
Sure.
And I'll say that we're starting to see a little movement from some employers.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, you're talking about career paths, not just the job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. We only have about 5 minutes left, and I just want to go around real quickly. Where are the positives in this? Where are the models in other cities that we could follow? What's the Hope Project promise to do? There's $30 million that, is part of CNY Rising. What can these do to really create something that we see that's different, that gets rid of those statistics where we started and starts to make them look not so unflattering?
I will say that the ESPRI, I'll leave the Hope Initiative to our director, but I think that the ESPRI right here in New York State gives us an opportunity to look at 15 communities, very different communities. Mm-hmm. And each of them take a look and peel back the onion of what's going on in their community, with the overall option is to look at all of what they've come up with and begin to cherry pick mm-hmm. what has been effective and what's working. And I just got to emphasize to people, it is the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. No one program, no one funding source, right. You know, $2.75 million for Syracuse is not going to solve poverty. Mm-hmm. We need to stop that pipe dream right now.
$30 million is not going to solve poverty.
Thank you.
$30 million was the ticket price to solve poverty. Every elected official would send down a $30 million check right. in all these cities is not the ultimate answer.
So what's the best way for that to start to work in this area? I mean, certainly an obvious one that we've discussed earlier seems to be to have some economic development that makes sure
absolutely.
That just one idea, you know, that could come out of that. How is that going to make the most impact, or how will we after 5 years see things are better, policies have changed, programs have started and are sustainable?
Well, I mean, I'll say, excuse me, Tim. I'll say that I'm part of an emerging coalition at Syracuse University, the Roots and Remedies Coalition, and we're really interested in thinking about the ways in which the knowledge resources of our campus can be put to good use through collaboration with community members focused on systemic poverty. And one of the real hopes of the sort of Alliance for Economic Inclusion funding is that we start thinking in innovative and creative ways, that we start getting a handle on the roots of poverty and thinking outside the box to understand remedies that will work to fundamentally shift that needle.
Instead of just throwing more resources at things that
haven't
necessarily
that we know as much, yes.
Right. And I just want to point out that it's not like these programs aren't doing really right. great, important work. Just like my role as a food justice scholar might be at times critical of emergency food, that's doing good work to make sure people are fed here now. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, we need to also engage in structural policy change.
Describe the HOPE initiative.
You asked what are the things that HOPE is promising to do. I guess I can boil it down basically to identify, dismantle, and humanize. Identify policies and systems that create barriers, dismantle those policies and systems, and humanize the individuals that are experiencing the conditions of poverty.
One last quick question, because we just have about a minute or so to go. City limits is WAER's promise to look at this issue for a year. Starting now, this is the kickoff. At the end of the month, we have a kickoff event for our website and podcast project. What should we cover? What should we shed more light on, investigate, examine over a year?
Well, before I answer that or let anybody else answer, I think what you're doing is a good start.
Yeah.
So I just want to make sure that's clear. Talking about it, getting more people, more perspectives, mm-hmm. You know, from a wide range of people. Hopefully it won't be just the same four here. I know it won't.
Right.
But I think that's a very important point as we start to look at the different mm-hmm. solutions. And the thing that Evan said I really like is creative, new solutions that may add on to others. Mm-hmm. I think that the answer lies within our community. It's just as a history, we may not have always engaged the whole community in trying to find those answers.
Mm-hmm. Getting the voices of individuals who are living in poverty and those who have triumphed over poverty and moved out, definitely having those voices in the room.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you all for taking part in City Limits of Poverty Project. This opening discussion will start, as I said, a year-long look at the issue, examination of poverty here in Syracuse. Thank you to Osha Keaton, director of the Syracuse HOPE Project, Tim Penix, vice president of SUNY Syracuse Educational Opportunity Center, Evan Weissman, Syracuse University food studies professor, and Sharon Owens, CEO of Syracuse Model Neighborhood Facility. Thanks for listening to this special presentation by WAER News and Public Affairs and City Limits, a Poverty Project. You can find out more, the facts, the figures, the stories, as well as a list of resources related to poverty here in Syracuse by going to a special website, citylimitsproject.org. For City Limits, I'm Chris Bolt, WAER News.